Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. That means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those with those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas, no desire to be in bed next to someone, if you know what I mean. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of these things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. And that's what women mention over and over in the reviews. There are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use our code, which is the acronym of the podcast, TSNOTYAW, at checkout. That's the podcast acronym at checkout at happymammoth.com.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
There and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Today's guest is a game designer, curator, and writer, originally from Adelaide and currently based in London. She wrote the script for the indie video game Dicey Dungeons, which won the Indiecade Grand Jury Award. She has written for The Guardian, among other publications. The Husbands is her first novel. It's my pleasure to welcome Holly Gramazio. Holly, I heard about this book originally from a indie bookseller who comes onto our show, who gives so many of our listeners comp titles so that when they query with their agents, they know which comps to use. And whenever Emily tells me to read something, I read it, because when she gets excited about it, it means she's going to be hand selling it. And that's exactly what you want from a bookseller. So just a shout out to Emily Samov, East City Bookshop. Right, now we're going to dive into all kinds of things about the book, but I would like to start at the beginning, especially since you're a debut novelist. Our listeners love hearing from debut novelists, the journey to publication, how they pitched the book, how they got their agent, etc., etc. So before we dive into that, for our listeners, I'm just reading you the flap copy so that you can see what an incredible hook this book has, right? So it is called The Husbands. When Lauren returns home to her flat in London late one night, she's greeted at the door by her husband, Michael. There's only one problem. She's not married. She's never seen this man before in her life. But according to her friends, her much improved decor and the photos on her phone, they've been together for years. As Lauren tries to puzzle out how she could be married to someone she can't remember meeting, Michael goes to the attic to change a light bulb and abruptly disappears. In his place, a new man emerges. and a new, slightly altered life reforms around her. Realizing that her attic is creating infinite supplies of husbands, Lauren confronts the question. If swapping lives is as easy as changing a light bulb, how do you know you've taken the right path? When do you stop trying to do better and actually start living? A thrilling original debut, The Husbands brilliantly explores how we navigate life, love, and choice in a world of never-ending options. When I saw this premise, Holly, I was like, oh my God, it's like a magical faraway tree, but for adults. And I loved that book as a kid. It was like every time the tree moved, it was somewhere else. Can you tell us a bit about how you got this idea and then how you pitched it?
I think the magic faraway tree is absolutely somewhere in the lineage. I love that book. I loved it so much as a kid. And also, obviously, things like Narnia and all of the other doors that open to other worlds. I think that the basic idea of jumping between lives and relationships and finding yourself quite a long way into it and trying to assess what that's like is something that I kind of played around with as an idea behind a text-based video game 6 or 7 years ago. And I couldn't really make it work. I just spent a day or two trying to do some prototyping, messing around, and went, nah, this isn't going anywhere. Set it aside. And then years later, came back to it and thought, oh, you know what? What if I just write out the words and people read them in order from beginning to end? And it's not a video game, almost like a book. And decided to give that a go. And it worked so much better in that form. And that's when the attic came into it as well, when I was thinking about what's the mode of shifting between these different lives and what's something that feels more like the lives being visited upon you than entering into them, right? So she doesn't step through a door into another life. The husband climbs down the attic and the life forms around her. I think part of the reason it's an attic is that it feels quite fun and light and non-threatening to have husbands descend from the attic. They're very vulnerable when they come down legs first. It's not like they're opening a door and stomping through. It's almost the opposite of, you know, men lurking in the cellar, which is a very sinister kind of thing. So that was part of it. And also partly just that as an Australian, we don't really have attics. It's not something that works there or that many places have. And so then I moved to the UK, having only encountered attics in kids' books, essentially, and in maybe sort of weird gothic novels where there's often a wife hiding up in an attic. And then coming to the UK where everyone has these rooms in their rooftops and are going like, oh yeah, the attic. Yeah, I think there might be like some old suitcases there, and there's definitely some boxes and a Christmas tree maybe. I'm not really sure. It's just such a weird thing to have this room in people's house that they don't really think about, don't go into, just shove stuff into to get it out of the way.
Yeah, and I loved, because that even felt like the magic faraway tree. So while the kids go up, the world's changed, you know, the kids have no control over that, and they find themselves in different situations each time. And it's the same, it's something above. Sometimes these men come down naked, sometimes they come down in their pajamas, all different things. So it was just really, really delightful. So Holly, our listeners are quite obsessed with genre, because it's so difficult to pinpoint the exact genre of your book. So this, would it be women's fiction with speculative elements? How is it that you pitch this? I mean, we hate the term women's fiction. Men can write what the bloody hell they want for whoever they want, and it isn't termed men's fiction. But when a woman writes predominantly about women for a woman audience, then it gets called women's fiction. But this does have these speculative elements in that the world is normal, with slight quirks, you know, that make it slightly unusual. So did you have to do a query letter and pitch an agent to get this book sold? Or did you happen to know somebody? How did you go about pitching this?
Yeah, the question of what genre it is so interesting to me as well, because I didn't really know when I wrote it. I just wrote the thing and went, well, I guess I'll discover what it is, what the thing that I want to write is as I do it, and got to the end and went, oh, I'm still not really sure. And it does seem to be listed differently in different places. So I think I've seen it in a speculative section of a catalogue. I've seen it in women's fiction, in general fiction. I've seen it in a literary fiction list. I've seen it in a lot of different places.
This kind of thing either bodes really well for the book because it means it straddles different genres, which means it's going to appeal to a wide group of people. Or sometimes that can work against a book because booksellers are like, I don't know where the hell in the bookstore to put this, right? Should I put it with speculative fiction? Should I put it with women's fiction? So, you know, sometimes that works against you. But the fact that a bookseller or a book buyer in Washington, D.C. is telling me this is such an incredible book means they don't really care what the genre is. They're going to sell the hell out of it anyway.
Yeah, I think it's a tricky sort of space to be in sometimes, but I obviously the book hasn't come out yet at the time that we're speaking, so you don't know, but it doesn't seem to have stopped people from finding it interesting or talking about it or wanting to pick up an advanced copy and have a read or whatever it might be. So I don't feel like that slight ambiguity of genre is getting in the way. I think people just see it where it's put and think, oh yeah, fair enough. Why not? And I think that kind of basically realist, but with one high concept non-realist thing in a book is something that's reasonably well understood, right? You can look at that and go like, oh, it's a bit like Groundhog Day. It's a bit like Palm Springs. It's a bit like Emma Straub's and This Time Tomorrow. It's a bit like the books that do that kind of thing. Jokes and a weird thing and then an otherwise realist world. So I don't feel like that's been obstructive, although obviously the publishers did a lot of work trying to figure out how to get to that point, how to make it a thing where you can sort of in a sentence get the idea across and have people understand it.
In terms of getting an agent, was that something you had to go through that whole process, or was it a case of working in video games, you already have an agent who then could introduce you to somebody? We're always interested to hear about the journey to publication and how long it took the book to sell.
Yeah, this is a slightly unsympathetically straightforward story. It was not very difficult for me to get an agent. The background to that was that I have worked in video games and in physical games as well, card games and things for museums and art galleries for a really long time. And maybe 7 or 8 years ago, a publishing house was interested in putting out a book version of a card game that I had designed. And it's really easy to get an agent when someone's already interested in publishing you, it turns out. A friend of mine, one of the very few writers I knew, introduced me to her agent to kind of talk through the process and what we should do now that we had had this publishing house approach us. This is me and my then colleague, Sophie Sampson, who had made the game together. She offered to sign up to represent us in that. We went and talked to them quite a lot and couldn't quite figure out a format for this book that was both something we wanted to do and something that they wanted to publish. So it kind of fell by the wayside. Nothing happened. Then, you know, 5 years later, I have technically a contractual relationship with this agent, messaged her very out of the blue going, you know, a much more polished version of, hey, you might have forgotten me, but technically we signed that contract all those years ago. Technically, you're kind of already my agent. Anyway, you will be horrified to learn I've written a novel. I'm really hoping that you feel obliged by politeness to read the first 3 chapters, which I've attached. It's about a woman who's at Magic Attic, starts creating an infinite supply of husbands. Let me know. Sorry.
Loved that.
Took it through lots of drafts to sound a little bit less weird and apologetic about it. And very fortunately for me, she read it, said, yeah, please send me the rest of it, sent it to her. She read that. And then we had a chat about it. She thought there were a couple of things that needed a bit more work, especially around the ending, but was happy to take me on, to take the book on.
Yeah, there are so many different journeys to publication and we love hearing them all because you never know what opportunity is going to lead to something like this. You know, something falls through 5 years ago and you're like, oh, well, that was a waste of time, but it really wasn't. And here we are today. I love seeing women game designers who are writing now. I mean, Naomi Elderman, you know, The Power and the Future, loved those books. I got to interview Naomi for an event recently. Is there something about game designing that really lends itself to storytelling when it comes to writing novels? Because I was somebody who missed the whole gaming thing, and I never saw it as storytelling. But now, obviously, I look at it and I'm like, oh my God, this is storytelling. Of course it's storytelling. So when it comes to sitting down and outlining the game, when it comes to outlining all of your chapters, because this must have had a lot of moving parts. So for our listeners, you know, there are different husbands that come at different times. Sometimes a husband comes back. Sometimes Lauren meets someone who was once her husband, but is not her husband in this particular life, and they're doing something else. So, you know, you juggling with Jell-O here, trying to keep track of all of these different things. Does the game designing element help when it comes to that, or how did you approach that?
I think there's absolutely some skills that you learn in game design that are incredibly applicable to writing a novel. One of them is just a really strong awareness in a game of what a player could know or could be doing at any given time. So you kind of need to know where they've come from, what they might have with them, all of this sort of thinking about how will they feel, what might they do next, because they are so non-linear most of the time in the way that you navigate them. You really have to think a lot about what people will bring to a particular scene. And so that, I think, is very useful. I definitely found it interesting thinking about structuring the husbands, thinking about what people might be thinking at particular times. Will they be going, oh, why doesn't she do this? Why doesn't she do that? And trying to kind of anticipate that in a way that felt very similar to when I write or design a video game. Another of them, I think, is about dealing with feedback and editorial suggestions. It's a kind of truism in game design that when someone tries out your game and tells you that something's wrong and tells you what you should change, that they're wrong about what you should change, but they're right about the feeling that they had. And what you need to do is find a usually different way to address that feeling and make it feel better for them. And that turns out to be something that people say all of the time in writing as well. So it was really useful to have, you know, 15 years of that ingrained into me and coming to that with, I think, more excitement about editorial comments than a lot of debut writers have. I think it can be very hard for the first sort of 5 years or so of showing the thing you've done to people and getting feedback to not feel incredibly defensive about that. Definitely, I struggled with that a lot during the first sort of 5 years of playtesting games. I'd look at people and think they're playing it wrong, or they'd tell me that they didn't enjoy something and make a suggestion and I'd be like, oh no, you've misunderstood entirely. This is your fault. And it felt like a real gift to come to writing a novel, having already worked through those feelings and having figured out how to respond to criticism in a more functional way.
Yeah, very much so. Do you find that feedback in game design is quicker? Is it a case of you do sort of one chunk of work and then you get feedback on it immediately so that you can correct those things before you move on? Or is that not how it works in game design? It's a case of you've got to design the whole thing and only later do you get feedback on it. Because I think where a lot of emerging writers go wrong, and this is because they don't have like beta readers, they don't have writing groups, right? They'll write 20 chapters going down the complete wrong path, and that might take them 6 months, and finally someone looks at it and is like, I kind of feel by chapter 3, you know, this is where we went wrong. And the writer realizes, oh shit, that's right. And they've got to go all the way back. And is it the same with game design, or you're able to fix things sort of quicker?
I think with game design, there's a couple of things going on there. One is it varies between people, obviously, but often you have this thing that gets called a core loop, which is the basic thing that you do over and over in the game. You know, you hit a monster and you get some points and you lose some health. You collect a card and then you play a card, whatever it might be. And usually it's quite easy to test a version of that core loop early on. Even sometimes for video games, you'll just do it with bits of paper and pen or something, because if you can make that core experience fun when you don't have any of the sound effects, any of the art, anything like that going on, then you know you've really got something exciting to work with. And then you can sort of build up on it from there, go in different directions, try out different things, bring other aspects of the game into it. So it is very often the case with games that you try out the fundamental thing early on, which you can't really do in a book in the same way, because it's not the same, like, here's one mechanic that will play out in different ways across the whole game. I think another part of it is that when you're making a game, you often build in some levers to be able to pull. You know what numbers you can increase or decrease to change the fun in different ways, to change the feeling in different ways. You know, if this is too hard, here are some different things you can do. If it gets boring at this point, here's a section that we can take out. If people want to know more about this character, here's a section where we could build on that a bit more. You put it together knowing that even after it's complete, there will be these little numbers that you can tweak and quite significantly change the experience. And that is not really a thing that you get in writing a novel at all. Or if it is, I haven't been able to figure out how it works. There's nothing where you can sneakily change one number in a spreadsheet somewhere and then the whole thing is like 8% faster paced or whatever. So that was a thing I slightly missed going through and having to make all of the sort of changes to mood and tone and rhythm and all of that constantly by hand. You can't put those levers in the same way.
I wish we could do those levers as writers. I think it would make things a lot easier. So two things that I want to ask you arising from that is, you know, this book had a very clear inciting incident. She comes home, there's a dude in her house, he's not her husband, right? So the first act is very clear cut. There's the inciting incident and the story goes on from there. And then your final act is, what is she going to do? What choice is she going to make? Is she going to keep doing this for the rest of her life? Is she going to be forced to make a decision? I feel like with a book like this, act two is where it's really tricky, because you can't just keep doing the same thing over and over where men just keep coming down, because that loses its novelty in the first act. And this is kind of where you need to be torturing your character in act two to constantly be upping the stakes. Did you find that that's a part where you struggled, or was it you knew upfront, okay, act two, these are the ways I have to keep adjusting it to make it interesting and new?
I didn't really think about it in a sort of three-act structure at all, to be honest. And I was, like you say, very keen to get the inciting incident out of the way really fast, partly because it is a bit of an odd thing and I wanted people to know what they're in for. You don't want to trick someone into reading a book and then in chapter 10 you suddenly drop a magic attic on them. You want them to decide in the first like five pages whether they buy into this concept or not. And if they don't, then fine, not the book for them. Plenty of other books that will be the book for them. So getting that kind of inciting incident out of the way so quickly kind of means it inevitably can't have a very standard three-act structure, because what would be the second act is just long. There's a lot of it there. The bulk of the book is what would be the second act if it had been structured like that. So I thought more about things like travelogues. I looked a lot at travelogues when I was thinking about structure. I looked at things like Langston Hughes' I Wonder As I Wander, which is his sort of autobiography about traveling around Europe and Asia in the 1920s. I looked at Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the Narnia one where they're just all on a boat going around a bunch of different islands. I looked at a game that a friend of mine, Magna Giant, and a studio called Inkle wrote called 80 Days, which is this kind of retelling of Around the World in 80 Days. And all of these different works have to find a way of structuring a quite episodic story. A thing happens and another thing happens and another thing happens, all in different places as well. Obviously, in The Husbands, it's all in Lauren's flat. but the people that she's with change a lot. Her life changes a lot as well, whether her friends are in contact with her or not. There's a lot of stuff that shifts. So it feels quite similar to this kind of moving from place to place. And they do things like having characters or people who recur at regular intervals, having little running jokes or difficulties or things that go there, having moments of rising tension and then relief, and rising tension and relief on a different kind of rhythm than you would get in a sort of a trad three act structure. And I dug into those a lot when thinking about how to do that, how to make it feel like a cohesive sort of propulsive whole while piecing it together from a lot of different this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens.
And just on that, you know, for our listeners, when we say there needs to be a lot happening, we're talking specifically about causality. You know, you don't want 10 different things happening all independently of each other at the same time. It needs to be dominoes tipping. A leads to B. She makes a decision in B, which leads to C. And so that you can see that whole causality of this web effect, everything's happening for a reason. And that you will see so brilliantly in here. Each decision she makes affects something else. I was giggling so much, Holly, with her neighbors. I don't want to give it away, but there was a scene with the neighbors and I was like, holy hell, I did not see this coming in this particular reality. But yeah, how she changes, how she's more polished in some instances, how she has more money in other instances. Having more money doesn't necessarily affect, you know, whether she's happier or not. So there was just so much, so much there. Something that I also want to point out is, you know, we generally say to emerging authors, try and avoid certain pitfalls when it comes to writing. And something a lot of emerging authors do is they have a, there I was minding my own business when beginning, right? We generally say immediately, have the character wanting something, going after something, it ups the stakes. But this is the perfect example of a, there I was minding my own business when this thing happened to me kind of beginning. And it works incredibly well. And it's only after this thing happens that Lauren starts to have wants and needs as stakes related to the story. Did you do that very purposefully?
I think I was very keen all along to have the sort of individual, what does she want right at this moment? What is the little problem that she's solving in this chapter running alongside? What does she want overall? And having that sort of thrumming along and driving it and resurfacing in different ways. So you have simultaneously that, oh no, how does she deal with this specific husband problem? But also, what does she do about this whole situation? What does she do about her life? Kind of driving it underneath there.
Yeah, so each instance she's got a new problem to deal with and it ups the stakes. I mean, there's an instance, I feel like I can tell our listeners, I mean, because I'm sure they can imagine it. What happens if the one guy comes down and you're like, oh my word, this is the guy for me. Really, really have connected with this guy. And then he has to go up into the damn attic for something. And then there your guy goes, you know? So there's always different things for her to be grappling with and that we as the reader are grappling with on her behalf. I'd like to ask, this book could very easily have been written in the first person. And I always say to our listeners, come to point of view with intentionality. Don't just be, oh, I'm going to write first person present tense because that's what I like. Or don't just write third person past tense because that's what I like. So what we have here is we have third person present tense and it's third person close. We stick with Lauren the whole time. Was there a point at which you decided on first person and was like, nah, I'm not going to do that? What was your approach to that?
The present tense is partly because it is this very sort of weird stuff happening, oh my God, beginning. And you do have to get not just the reader to buy into it, but get the reader over the hump of Lauren believing it. It's very easy, really, comparatively for a person reading a book to go, oh, okay, I will believe for the purposes of this book that there's a magic attic. But I found it more difficult to figure out how to get people to go, okay, for the purposes of this book, I believe that this character believes in a magic attic. That was a quite weird challenge. And I just found that present tense really helped you stick with her realization and confusion and acceptance and experimentation more closely and would kind of guide people over that. And the third person, there's a couple of reasons behind that. One is that I did want to have a little bit of distance from Lauren and give people that kind of scope to stand a little bit further away and look at her with a little bit of curiosity or criticism in a way that is doable, obviously, in First Present, but I think a little bit harder. Another is that, you know, Christopher Isherwood, the sort of 20s and 30s English writer, he wrote Mr. Norris Changes Trains and he wrote the short story that became Cabaret eventually. There's a thing that he does throughout his writing that I think is very, very interesting, where he kind of gets at people's feelings, usually from a first-person narrator point of view, by describing their bodily actions. Like, he's just so good at having his observer character, who's usually himself, quite often called Christopher Isherwood, look at other people and describe them, and you never have the narrator saying, oh, I thought she felt such and such. You just have the narrator noticing the action and doing it. And I thought that that would be an interesting thing to kind of play around with, but in a close third, because Lauren is not always very good at knowing what her feelings and desires are. And if sometimes I could describe not what she was feeling, but what she was doing or how physical parts of her body felt rather than how she felt emotionally as an access point to that, that seemed like a fun thing to try out to see if I could get that to work.
Yeah, and you really, really did. Last question before our interview ends is, a lot of writers express frustration, especially debuts, in terms of once they've written this kind of book, it's women's fiction with a speculative element, their publishers want them to stay in their lane. It's like, okay, we want you, Holly, to be known as the speculative element kind of women's fiction writer. Is that something that you feel frustrated by, or is it a case of you can now move on to whatever you want and don't have to worry about being branded a certain way or being marketed in a certain way as a writer with your next novel?
Possibly because I came to writing novels not super late or anything, but not straight out of university. I'm 42 now. I have this kind of backlog of ideas that I would like to have a go at and that I'm excited about and interested by. And I think it would feel very stressful and strange to sit down and go, right, now I have to have an idea that fulfills these four key marketing criteria. Obviously, working in games sometimes for clients, I've had to do that a lot, but that's the sort of thing where it is client work and you're delivering it to their specifications and you care about and you try to make it good, but it doesn't require quite the same level of, you know, finding bits of yourself to haul out and smudge down on the page and go, hey, hope you like it. It's a different kind of experience. So I think I would find that very difficult. But I'm fairly lucky, I think, in that the kind of not super easily classifiable genre position of the husbands means that I haven't been feeling like particularly intense pressure to do the same again, but a little bit different. Obviously, I would like to write a thing next that appeals to the people who might pick it up because they enjoyed The Husbands. I don't want to immediately go off and go, okay, this is the time for like a far distant future, hard sci-fi, murder mystery thriller. But it doesn't feel like a hardship to look at the things that I want to write anyway and think, which of these makes sense to do next? What's something that might feel good next to The Husbands that I would be excited about writing? If it's not such and such an idea, maybe I do that the one after, maybe I do that the one after that. I do have a couple of ideas that I like a lot that I'm steering clear of thinking about too much for the moment, just because they feel like they would be a very baffling next read after The Husbands.
Yeah, but I think there's certain things about your writing that your readers are going to love no matter what you write. There's plenty of social commentary. There's observational humor in it. You force us to ask a lot of questions of our own lives. Like, what have I settled for? Did I settle for this? Had I not done this, would something like this be out there for me? And I feel like no matter what you write, these are the kinds of questions you're going to bring to your reader and kind of blowing their minds in those ways. So Holly, we wish you much success with The Husbands and with whatever you're working on next. And we hope to have you back again.
Thank you so much for having me. I have had such a nice time talking about the nitty-gritty of some of this. I could definitely have done twice as long of just little writing thoughts. Thank you so much.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday, the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which six amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamaray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another awesome comp segment with Emily Summer from East City Bookshop. Emily, welcome back.
Thank you, Bianca.
Thank you for taking the time to go through all of our comps for us and to just keep adding to our to-be-read piles. You mentioned Holly Gramazio to me quite a few months ago when we were doing comps, and I actually, based on your recommendation, reached out, got an ARC of the book, read it, loved it, and I've just interviewed her, and I can't wait for this book to come out in the world.
Oh, I am so glad to hear it. I loved the book. I was lucky enough to meet Holly at a pre-publication event in DC, and she was delightful. I am so glad that more people will find out about it.
With Claire Lombardo, right?
That's right.
I'm so jealous. I told her that I was jealous that she got to see you and Claire.
It was a very fun event.
Amazing, amazing. Okay, right. We have got 8 comps this month that we're looking at. For our listeners, please try and get in your comps as early as possible. We are taping early this month on the 14th. Rather than a bit later, because our schedules get quite busy. So if you can get in your comp requests as early as possible, you'll be guaranteed that we will get to them. Okay, here's our first one, Emily.
Okay, so when I hear Patrick Rothfuss, I immediately think about Robin Hobb's Farseer trilogy. This is my favorite trilogy to recommend to people who want something to follow up Patrick Rothfuss. Those were released in the mid-90s, but they were just repackaged, as in the last few months, and re-released. So they are definitely seeing a resurgence, which I think might mean that they are not too old. I think they are finding new life, new readers, and getting new attention. So I would suggest looking at Robin Hobb to replace the Patrick Rothfuss comp. I think Peter Brett might be also worth looking at in the same vein. And for a more grown-up, adult Tamora Pierce vibe, I always recommend Deborah Harkness and Naomi Novik. So hopefully some combination of those titles will work.
Amazing. Okay, here's the second one.
Thank you for listening. It's always nice when people start their voicemail and take a few of their precious seconds to say that they enjoy the podcast and what Bianca and her team are doing. I think that The Teacher and Reputation are very good comps, especially together. Even if they don't check every box, I get a complete picture, I think, of what you're talking about when I hear those two books mentioned together. Another book that I will throw out as a possibility is Locust Lane by Stephen Amidon. That just came out last year. I think it did very well. It sold well for us anyway. I really enjoyed it. And I thought of that book because it is about the death of a young woman in a community and a neighborhood. And you see different teenagers. So it is not school focused, but it definitely has a sort of suburban high school feel to it. So that, I think, is a possibility. I would also suggest S.A. Cosby's All the Sinners Bleed, which hopefully I've mentioned in the past because he is just so good. All the Sinners Bleed is his most recent. I thought of that one because it starts with the murder of a teacher. So it begins in a school and goes from there. It is not really focused on sort of the state of schools and education today, but he is definitely a writer who writes and offers social commentary. So even though it's probably not the same themes and social commentary as in your book, he does go there. And also everybody should read S.A. Cosby because he's just fantastic. Another author I will suggest is Robin Harding, because I think that she does a good job of writing these sort of suburban, domestic, parent, like a lot of parent-teen thrillers, and there might be one of hers that has a similar tone or similar theme. But again, I think The Teacher Meets Reputation is really compelling.
Thanks, Emily. Shout out to Robin Harding, Canadian author. Woohoo, Robin.
Woohoo.
Okay, number 3.
Hi, Linda. Thank you for calling in. As soon as I heard your description and I heard Sweet Spot Vibes by Amy Popel, I thought about Abby Waxman. I think she writes with a lot of the same vibes as Amy Popel and The Sweet Spot, and she has several different books to choose from. They are not romances, but I think that they do, a lot of them might have the same themes of like someone changing her life and going through a transformation later in life. I think that, and it would definitely hit that sweet spot vibes. Along the same lines, I will suggest Catherine Center. Catherine Center is the same vibes, I believe, as Amy Popel and Abby Waxman, but she definitely writes rom-coms. So she could have one that really meets what you need. And she is just so good. I love Catherine Center. I love her books. I like that she features slightly more mature heroines. I won't say old. They are certainly not old, but they're not, you know, these are not rom-coms about a 25-year-old usually. So I would look at Abby Waxman and Catherine Center, and then maybe Jasmine Guillory's Royal Holiday. That one has such a specific setting that it might not work exactly, but it's a really good book. And I love Jasmine Guillory. So shout out to her.
Marvelous. Okay, here's number 4.
Hi, Emily. Bianca suggested that I reach out after Deep Dive series. I'm really hoping you can help me with some comps here. In a world where people have become so addicted to the stream, they've lost their ability to form long-term memories and are vulnerable to government manipulation, heiress and socialite Rani wears her public image like armor in hopes of protecting her secret. She remembers everything. When she discovers that her equally famous boyfriend, Bowen, has been unknowingly spying on her and having his mind erased, they must choose between each other or revealing the truth to the adoring public that hangs on their every move. Forced to flee the city, the pair are plunged into a world of uncertain alliances, rebel factions, and dealing with the withdrawals of unplugging, while news of their untimely death is planted, starting the ticking clock on their race to do the right thing. It's written in first-person POV as a journal that's been left behind by the main character, and I tend to pitch it as Gossip Girl meets William Gibson. I know those seem fairly lofty, though, so if you have any recommendations, that would be great.
Okay, I love Gossip Girl meets William Gibson, because those are two things that I would not have thought to put together. I immediately sort of get the gist of where you're going, but I agree that those are sort of lofty, big, and not super recent. I might suggest using Followers by Megan Angelo in lieu of Gossip Girl, because that is a book that is concerned with influencers and social media and the dangers of technology, but in sort of an influencer socialite space, that it has that feel. And then instead of William Gibson, I might use Blake Crouch, my favorite, who you've heard me mention in the past, or Ernest Cline. So they're both more recent. They're not quite as big as William Gibson. But I think Followers by Megan Angelo gets the sort of social media tech stream danger. And then Blake Crouch and Ernest Cline get the action and race against time aspect.
Thank you. Okay, here's number five.
Okay, again, y'all are really good at coming up with these comps and combos and books that I never would have thought of. So News of the World meets Game of Thrones is extremely unusual and definitely caught my attention. So I don't know, maybe you go with that. We talk sometimes in the bookstore when we are thinking about books, when they're pitched to us for events, we talk about a book having that sort of like head tilt factor, where as soon as you hear about it, you're like, huh, how about that? So I definitely have the head tilt voucher, which is a good thing, very much a good thing, when I hear News of the World meets Game of Thrones. Instead of News of the World, I might suggest Renee Denfield's The Child Finder, because when I hear News of the World, I think of much longer ago historical fiction, the 1988. But The Child Finder has the same missing boy plot. It has a survival in a forest plot. And Renee Denfeld is especially good at writing compassionate and complex characters of all types. So when you say that that there's a sympathetic villain who's just trying to please his parents, I think Renee Denfeld writes along those lines. Like, she's very good at recognizing those complexities and how trauma shapes us. But I think The Child Finder might have the sort of young boy in a forest feel. For the paranormal, I'm stumped with Sasquatch. I got nothing for Sasquatch, unfortunately, which might be a very good thing for your book, because there might be a hole in the market where we need more. But in terms of paranormal thrillers that we love in our store and that readers love, I would suggest Lauren Bukes. I never know if I'm just saying her right, saying her name right. It's Beukes. And Katrina Ward and Victor Laval. So I would just look at other like paranormal thrillers, and I don't think any of them have a Sasquatch in there, but maybe some of them will fit the bill.
Thank you. Here's number six.
Okay, so as soon as I heard the description of Alice's imprisonment and the 1906 trial and actual events, I thought about Sarah Collins' book, The Confessions of Franny Langton. So it is a few years old. It came out before the pandemic, but there has been a new TV series. I think it's a series and not a movie. So again, it has had a recent, like within the last year, resurgence. I think it's still timely. And that is a book that is historical fiction about a trial, imprisonment. I think it was inspired by true events. If not, it was just so well written that it seems like it could be. So I would definitely look at The Confessions of Franny Langton. I think it will fill the comp role of like Fever 1793 and The Sewing Girl's Tale. And then for a good blend of historical fiction and time travel, I will suggest The God of Endings by Jacqueline Holland, which came out last year. And Connie Willis also does a great job of blending time travel and historical fiction. And I think the best one and the one I'm thinking of is The Year of the Dog. It's something similar to that. But if you Google Connie Willis, I think you'll find something that could work. That's a little older. But hopefully some combination of those plus The Confessions of Franny Langton will make sense.
Off topic, but something you said made me think of it. Have you or did you read Notes on an Execution when it came out, Emily?
I did, and I loved it.
Holy hell, man. That book. I read that and Bright Young Woman back to back. And those two books together were just like, oh my God.
Yes. I have not read Bright Young Woman yet, although I have a copy and it's on my list. But I think both of them take the narrative away from the killer and give you completely different perspectives. I highly recommend the Dania Kukavka. I loved it. We read it in my book club and people were very moved by it.
And definitely get Bright Young Woman. I started reading, listening to it on audio, and I was like 10 pages in and I was like, oh my God, these sentences on a line level are so amazing that I have to go and get the book so that I can mark it up. And that doesn't happen with me very often. So
I love it when that happens. The last time that happened with me was Up They're Gonna Love You by Meg Howery. I was listening to that one and I was like, I have to underline and write these sentences down. Very, very different tonally and thematically, but another excellent book.
Mm-hmm. I'm adding it to the list. Okay, here's number 7.
Okay, so The Online Webcam Girlfriend and the Need for Connection immediately made me think of a book that I think I mentioned last month, and it's coming out soon. It's called Margot's Got Money Troubles by Rufy Thorpe, who is one of my auto-buy authors. I just want everybody to read Rufy Thorpe because she is so wonderful. But Margot is having money troubles, as the title tells you, and becomes an OnlyFans I don't know the word for it. Anyway, she goes on OnlyFans and ends up having a connection with one of her fans who is paying to watch her on OnlyFans. Another along similar lines is Made for Love by Alyssa Nutting. That one is not a webcam girlfriend. There is a sex doll in that one, but it is definitely about the need for connection. And there's a lot of action in it. It is wild. So tonally and like voice wise, I don't know if either of those would work. So on a completely different tone, but dealing with themes of coming of age, addiction, the need for human connection, I will suggest Ohio by Stephen Markley. Again, could not be different in terms of the feel of the book and the vibe of the book than Rufy and Alyssa Nutting. But maybe somewhere in between those, you'll find something that resonates. In terms of the human trafficking and action vibes, maybe look at Don Winslow and Jordan Harper. So all of those books are very different, but maybe some combination of them will work.
Thank you, Emily. And here's our last one.
Hi, Heidi. Thank you for calling in. Anytime I hear there's a wilderness guide or we're out in the wilderness, I suggest Peter Heller. He is the best at writing action books that have real like literary merit and character development. And he is, I think, the king of books that are thrilling, but not a thriller, as you said. So absolutely, I would look at Peter Heller. I would also maybe consider Chris Bajalian, who incidentally has the same editor, I think, as Peter Heller. I think they are both Jenny Jackson's authors. I'm a huge Jenny Jackson super fan. And I thought of Chris Bajalian because I think that he is a good mix of Ann Patchett and Leanne Moriarty with action and lots of plot. Again, like a not thriller, thrilling, but not a thriller, and a good mix of plot and character development. In terms of sort of a midlife coming of age, I might suggest Mary Beth Keane. So her books are definitely family dramas. They are not the sort of action-based book that it sounds like this is, but they are about finding oneself. They are often characters who are in midlife. And I thought of her specifically because I think she is a really good halfway point between like the literary writing of Ann Patchett and the upmarket sort of commercial vibe of Leanne Moriarty. So because you mentioned those two, I think Mary Beth Keane is worth looking at too. And she's just great. So those are my suggestions. It was a short list today.
Yeah, and which means next month's going to be super long as everyone wakes up again. So
we'll be ready for it.
For our listeners, go to the Shit About Writing, look for the Ask a Question page, and you get to record your comp request there. And as per usual, the more information you give Emily in terms of tone and themes, etc., the better help she can be. Emily, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to next month.
Thank you, Bianca. I'll see you all soon.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.